Okay, we want to get started. Please do continue. I'm sorry we anticipated so many people coming, we couldn't put up tables in here. But when we get to our new building, we'll be able to take care of that problem. Thank you. Welcome. We're glad you're all here. When Victor said that we wanted to hold a conference on Thursday before, you know, Christmas holidays, I said, "You're crazy, Victor. Well, nobody's going to come for that. You know, what are you talking about?" And of course, I wasn't thinking and hadn't anticipated what a profound thing it is to sit back and reflect on this election that Korea had. Remarkable, really. Remarkable election. You know, it put America to shame. 75% of Koreans got out in some of the worst weather and voted. You know, I mean, what a great testament to democracy, and just an outpost of democracy and civilization in Asia. And it's something to celebrate, genuinely celebrate. And of course, it was a very important election. Lots of things are starting to pivot in Asia in very, very important ways. We've had an election in Japan, very substantial. I think the aftershocks are still continuing. And this election, I think, has enormous implications for Northeast Asia. And we're going to explore that today. And we've got three of the finest minds joining Victor Cha to do that. And so I want to say thank you to all of you. It's going to be a very good session. We look forward to having your questions animate it. Want to say a special thank you to KEI and to CFR for partnering with us on this, because it is such a big thing. And we're grateful to have that opportunity. Victor, why don't I turn it over to you, and you can get this going for real. And colleagues, thank you for coming. We're glad you're here. Why don't you come on up, and let's get to the stage, and we'll get it going. Thanks, everybody.
Joe, you're over there. Yeah.
Great. Are you ready? Good afternoon. My name is Abraham Kim from the Korea Economic Institute. I want to welcome all of you here to our last and final panel discussion on Korean elections. 2012 was a very important year for the Republic of Korea with two national elections. In April, of course, we had the National Assembly election and now the December presidential election. And CSIS, KEI, and Council on Foreign Relations have been organizing these post-election programs to analyze the results and their broader implications. I think this is the third platform that I'm sharing with my friend Victor and Scott, and we welcome Ambassador Detrani. Being a moderator for the third time makes me want to consider perhaps doing a career change from policy to broadcast journalism. And also, I was given a note that we are also not only streaming this program, but also we are taking questions and comments on the Twitter world. And the Twitter hashtag is #ROKElection, all in one word. So if you want to monitor that, and those of you in the virtual world would like to send us some questions, we'll take some of those later on as well. In April, I think we were all surprised by the results of the National Assembly elections when the Saenuri-dang, or the New Frontier Party, under the leadership of Madam Park Geun-hye, held on to a narrow majority in the assembly when most Korea watchers thought that they would lose by significant margins. This result, of course, set Madam Park on a course to run for the presidency. Her road to the Blue House was nothing short of dramatic, full of twists and turns along the way, but her steady demeanor and focused campaign led her to capture the presidency. The statistics and the symbolism, as we've already discussed, are pretty amazing. Here are a few. The first woman president to take this office in a fairly male-dominated society. The first president to win an absolute majority of the votes, the results being 51.6% to 48%, ahead by more than 1 million votes ahead of candidate Moon Jae-in. All the previous presidents who won this office did it with less than 50%. Voter turnout, as Dr. Hamry already mentioned, was over 75%. And not since 1997, during the middle of the Asian financial crisis, when Kim Dae-jung took office, did we have such high turnout like this. And she really broke the stereotype among pundits who said, you know, high turnout means good for the progressive candidate and bad for the conservative candidate. But in fact, in this case, we saw a tremendous turnout for the conservative candidate. So to help us to make some sense of the implications of this election, we're really privileged today to have three experts on this panel. And they are no strangers to our community. All of you have their detailed bios on the back of your program, so I won't go into too much detail about who they are. But first, I want to introduce Ambassador Joseph Detrani. Currently, he's affiliated with the National Institute of Public Policy. But before this, he had a long, distinguished career in the intelligence community. He recently stepped down as the director of National Counterproliferation Center in January 2012. But in the Korea policy community, of course, we know him for being the North Korea mission manager at the Office of Director of National Intelligence, the special envoy for the six-party talks, and the U.S. representative at the Korean Peninsula Energy Development Organization. And then to his left is Victor Cha, the senior advisor and Korea chair at CSIS and professor of government at the Director of Asian Studies at Georgetown University. And then finally, Scott Snyder, senior fellow for Korean Studies and the director of the Program on U.S.-Korea Policy at the Council on Foreign Relations. So gentlemen, let's get started. All of you collectively have decades of experience watching South Korea. In your view, why was this election particularly significant? And were there any surprises? Let's start off with you, Joe.
Well, my personal view is I wasn't surprised with Ms. Park winning the election. No unique insights on that. I think she came in with a strong agenda. Certainly, her views with respect to the domestic issues were powerful. I think the generation that appreciated some of the other issues. I think the older generation came out significantly in the 40s and above for her. I think her views on North Korea. This is an area that I'm a little more familiar with. Sort of resonated with the electorate, her views with respect to principled negotiations and a principled approach to resolving these issues and reaching out, but reaching out in a very meaningful way based on a lot of experience, because there's been so much disappointment in relations with the North. So no, I'm not surprised with the election, and I think Ms. Park will bring in a very powerful administration that works not only domestic issues, but in international issues. And indeed, with respect to the bilateral relationship with the United States, I think we will just continue to be that much more united and powerful in our approach to international issues.
How about you, Vic?
I mean, I have to admit I was a little bit surprised because, I mean, it was a statistical tie going into the last days of the election. And, you know, the sort of scenarios that everybody was playing out was that once the third party candidate dropped, that this would sort of push things more in the opposition's direction. But it was not only that. I mean, I think it was also sort of this feeling that, you know, 5 years of the current conservative government ending so unpopularly, the fact that the economy was at least perceived to be not doing well. You know, usually these sorts of things push an electorate in the direction of change and alternating from conservative to a liberal, and those things just didn't play out. And so, in that sense, I was a little bit surprised that she won by as narrow as the margin was. It was still, as you said, over a million votes, and that was quite significant. And I guess what's interesting is that, you know, the question that scholars can ask is, so is this still, in some sense, a reaction to, you know, we had two successive progressive governments in Korea for 10 years. between Kim Dae-jung and Nom Wi-hun. Then we had the shift now to Lee Myung-bak, and then, I mean, I don't, Park Geun-hye is clearly not Lee Myung-bak, but it is another more conservative government. So, you know, the pendulum shifted 10 years in one direction towards a more progressive political spectrum, and now is it shifting in the other direction for what will be another 10 years of right-of-center politics? And so I guess I wasn't expecting that to happen. I was, no one could make a prediction, but I think, you know, there was, you know, an inkling that it might go in the other direction. So I was surprised, but at the same time, you know, I think she's a very, very capable person. And we'll talk about that, but I think in that sense it was a little bit of a surprise for me.
Scott. Yeah. Well, I have to admit that I wasn't surprised by the outcome, but I was definitely surprised by the way that things played out, because as I had insomnia and was trying to sleep but watching the turnout numbers, I thought it was going to be a lot closer. I thought it was going to be a nail-biter. Then the exit polls came out with Park on top, and that really made me think that Moon might have a chance, because Korean exit polls are not always very good. But, you know, it was a surprisingly comfortable margin. And, you know, Victor mentioned a number of, you know, background factors that, you know, show why this is exceptional. I'd like to say that I don't know whether Park, it's not clear how to, I think it's too early to say how to characterize Park, because the platform actually was centrist. And we know a lot of the advisors are on the right, but I think that as was the case with Lee Myung-bak, you know, moving from the campaign to governing, where we saw a centrist agenda that turned into a conservative kind of cliquish sort of group in power, you know, Park is pledging not to do that, and we'll just have to see exactly how it plays out.
Okay. Back to you, Scott. You know, elections are really a window into society, and specifically we can, through these elections, by the issues that the various candidates campaign about, we get kind of periodic glimpses into values and concerns of the national community and how they change over time. And this year, of course, some of the issues that were discussed were things like social welfare issues, such as income disparity, future of Chaebols, and even the legacy of the late President Park Chung-hee. What is your assessment of how Korean society and politics have changed? What did you see change in this election from perhaps previous elections about Korean society?
Well, I think that the convergence of the two campaign platforms shows that everybody understands what the issues are, and mostly they're economic. Household debt issues, inequalities, economic inequalities, the feeling that people are being left out of growth. You know, there is a consensus that these are issues that really need to be dealt with. Social welfare system, needing to strengthen the social safety net. So we know exactly what Koreans feel is important. The question now is, how can the government really deliver on some of those kinds of issues? But, you know, that's definitely where the electorate's focus is. In terms of the broader results, I mean, one thing that is obvious is, demographics. Korean society is getting older. And that turns out, if you look at the generational cohorts, especially compared to 10 years ago, to be the key to Park's win. She was running and trying to appeal to an electorate that was on average older than the past. And so you have this very interesting and I think complicated tension between the older generation and the younger generation. And so that kind of cleavage as it played out in terms of support rates is a challenging issue. It's been there for a while, but I think it's one, you know, that the results of the election kind of, you know, underscores. The other thing I'll just say is I personally think, even though Park didn't campaign on a women's issue platform, it's very interesting to contemplate Park as a female role model, because we know that Korean society is changing, especially the younger generation. And I think to have a woman as president is probably going to have some influence on how Korean women think about where they can go in the workplace and in their careers.
Victor, do you have any?
No, I mean, I would agree with, particularly with, I mean, I agree with everything Scott said, but the, particularly the point about how this election was really a battle for the center. And not just as an electoral dynamic, but substantively it was a battle for the center. And, you know, this trying to thread this needle of raising Korean economic growth levels to what the Koreans are used to, 5.5, 6%, but at the same time doing it in a way that doesn't leave people behind and that finds jobs for the, you know, large number of college-educated but unemployed or underemployed youth in Korea. I mean, that's a tough needle to thread. But I think both candidates were trying to offer a vision for that. And so I think that's why, I mean, the election in that sense was about an issue and a vision. While I agree that we don't know what direction she's going to go in, there, as you said, Abe, there are a lot of things that are unique about her presidency, not one of which, as we were talking in the green room, is that she's been here before. She's been in the, she's lived in the Blue House before, and in that sense, may not be as vulnerable to some of the political imperatives that politicians feel once they inhabit the Blue House, the White House, whatever.
Let's move from the results to the to kind of the broader implications of this election on foreign policy. Joe, your expertise is on North Korea, and one of the common themes throughout the election campaigns of the various candidates was they're going to break from the current administration, President Lee Myung-bak's North Korea policies. And one of the themes were, you know, we need to engage North Korea more. And of course, we just had the recent rocket launch as well. So in your view, how do you think the ROK's North Korea policy might change under the new administration? And what does this mean for the broader security of the peninsula?
No, it's a great question, and especially with the rocket launch this month. There's a new government. We all know a new government in Pyongyang. Kim Jong-un, I think there was some expectation that there would be change, and there could be change coming out of Pyongyang and so forth. He made some very significant personnel decisions initially, and even was looking at some agricultural reform issues on a pilot scale. And what have you, but the rocket launch in April and then in December sort of dashed a lot of these expectations that there would be something. So I think it puts in the court of the new administration the responsibility and the challenge of working these issues that are so important for all of us, certainly for the ROK, but indeed in a regional and a global sense, getting some sort of reconciliation, getting some sort of results with North Korea, because we're still looking at the 2005 joint statement. We're still looking at a North Korea that has said over the years that they're prepared to denuclearize and become a legitimate nation state, but we see these activities like this most recent rocket launch and so forth. So that has to be a challenge for the Park administration. But my sense would be that she will continue to be principled, that there would have to be something on the part of the North Korean side to show confidence building, to show that they're prepared to move towards their stated commitment to denuclearize and to become a legitimate nation state and so forth, and not to sort of violate UN Security Council resolutions with total impunity and saying, we have a sovereign right, so be it, although they're members of the United Nations. I think this is really going to be a challenge for her and the administration of finding that middle path where you reach out and you want to engage, certainly in a humanitarian sense, because people are malnourished and there's a humanitarian issue involved here. But there's also a very pronounced issue here of 10 years of negotiations with absolutely no results. On the contrary, it's gone the other way, where North Korea now is flaunting some of these things, as we see with the missile launches. So it's got to be a challenge for the Park administration of of how you modulate your policy towards North Korea, because there's got to be some sort of movement on that issue. It just can't be dormant and so forth. There needs to be movement there. I would expect that the new administration, Park administration, would reach out, but would expect some reciprocity on the part of the North Koreans to show a willingness to indeed implement the September 2005 joint statement.
Well, starting with the missile launch, you know, I guess one of the first things that the new administration would have to decide is, do they see this as an act against the previous administration and therefore they're starting from a clean slate? Or do they see this in the broader terms as a significant crossing of a technological threshold and something that's a threat, to Korea, but also beyond Korea? And so I think that's going to be one decision they have to make initially. Based on her foreign affairs article and conversations, you know, clearly she is of a mind of being open to some sort of opportunity for engagement with North Korea. But, this isn't unconditional engagement. I mean, I think there's going to be a desire to see something on the part of the North Koreans on hard security issues, whether that's conventional or the conventional deployments, or whether it's on the nuclear stuff. I would imagine that she is going to de-link humanitarian assistance from any of these sorts of nuclear issues. But the other thing I think we have to remember is that, you know, the North Koreans are not necessarily going to sit still.
Sure.
While she gets her office in order. We've done a study here at CSIS that shows that the North Koreans tend to do provocations within 16 to 18 weeks of every South Korean election going back to 1992, whether that's presidential or legislative election. So personally, I'm entirely expecting another North Korean provocation within the next few months. And then the POC, President Park, is going to have to decide whether she's going to push against that tide or simply allow the North Koreans to make choices for her in terms of responding. I mean, I thought that her initial statements, and of course we're all watching every single word she says now that she's been elected, very clearly prioritized national security. She said that was clearly one of her priorities, which I think one could take to read that she does take this missile launch last week quite seriously, and probably sees some need to address it. So, but again, I think a lot of this will, as it often does, depend on what the North Koreans do, because we all end up reacting to what the North Koreans do. And if they do some sort of provocation in the coming weeks, coming months, her decision may already be made for her then.
I mean, I agree that North Korea always tests a new South Korean leader in various forms. They want to figure out what the parameters of the relationship and, frankly, what they think they can get out of it.
Sure.
And so, you know, we're going to face that particular period. It really means that Madam Park needs to have, she's already laid out, I think, a pretty clear sense of her set of priorities. It's really a synthesis, I think, of the Sunshine Policy and an emphasis on national security. And so she's kind of sending the signal that the doors are open, but to potential for dialogue, North Korea has to accept that. And, you know, the other thing I would emphasize is that it's a short window in terms of transition to administration. And there are actually decisions that are almost immediate that have to be made in terms of how you want to frame any kind of future relationship with North Korea. And so, you know, in some respects, I think the danger is that transitions haven't always been smooth. And so there's a risk, I think, inherent in this compressed time frame and the nature of Korean transition that can have an effect on getting, on leaving open the possibility for getting to a more stable inter-Korean relationship.
So what I'm hearing is we in collectively may expect some trouble before things will either get better or maintain the current status quo.
Now, I'm of the school that things should not get any more tense, that the North Koreans could show a little more confidence building on their part. So they tend to challenge new administrations, certainly for the U.S. or for the ROK, and in this instance, they maybe change their playbook and not further escalate, not make the situation that much more tense, but to show a willingness to sort of, they've been provocative enough with two launches in 1 year. Sure. So hopefully they will change their playbook on this. And I think that would be a very key indicator, indeed, if they do, to show a willingness to engage or to re-engage in a positive way. And indeed, if Victor and Scott are correct, and I think the record indicates that it's more likely they are correct, because that has been the case in the past, that would be very, very unfortunate. Because I think the element of patience with the international community, certainly I think with the ROK, the U.S., and so forth, is really reaching a very dangerous point where one has to wonder about how much effort you can make, how many overtures you can make to the North, and then to be rebuffed in a rather significant way, and then to be for them to expect you to come back again with an element of largesse. That's to me is going to be an interesting period. So hopefully the North changes its playbook in the next few months, and we see a different approach.
You know, this point about they like to test a new government, I think that's right. The concern I have is that the tests are getting more and more dangerous. Because if it's a conventional provocation, since China, we're in a completely different environment now when it comes to conventional provocations by North Korea. You know, i.e., the South Koreans are going to respond to conventional provocations. Mm-hmm. And then if it's something beyond a conventional provocation, if it's a third nuclear test, that's also quite concerning, because it could be a third test that tells us something about their nuclear weapons program that we don't want to know. You know, that they've miniaturized, or that they've done a successful high yield test, or whatever it is, or another missile test which would show reliability of this longer range technology. So I guess my concern is that we're getting to the point now where the tests are getting more and more dangerous across the spectrum. And how a new South Korean government responds to that is going to be very difficult, I think. So.
Victor, let me ask you. Now, one of the important partnerships, of course, to deal with North Korea is the United States. And as you know, there's a lot of issues over the horizon that U.S. and ROK needs to deal with in the new administration. Especially, I know I've not only North Korea issues, but I've heard you talk about the upcoming 1-2-3 agreement negotiation. You characterized in our last meeting that this was a slow train wreck happening, as well as things like OPCON transfer and other burden sharing and other things like that. Do you anticipate dramatic changes in the U.S.-Korea relations with the new Park administration, or do you think it's going to continue to grow?
I think that the overall tone and confidence in the relationship will be there. I mean, I think with the Park Geun-hye government, both Washington and Seoul will operate from the view that these two governments do believe that the alliance relationship is important. It's a normative good, mm-hmm. Which you might not necessarily have gotten if we had a Moon government that came in. They would have said the same things, but the sort of core belief and the confidence of the relationship may not have been there the way it would be with a Park Geun-hye administration. And I'm sure the Obama administration would want to continue to build on what they rightly saw as a very strong relationship between themselves and Lee Myung-bak. Mm-hmm. But this doesn't mean it's all going to be smooth sailing, quite obviously. I mean, I think sort of you mentioned it. I mean, the issues, the first is, to me, is that so we have the U.S.-Korea Free Trade Agreement, but it's benefited both countries, but we still need to see full implementation, of CORUS, and then figure out between us what the agenda is after CORUS. And so a bit of shameless CSIS advertising, Matt Goodman, who is our Scholl chair, has been working on a project that looks at sort of what the agenda would be between the U.S. and ROK beyond the free trade agreement. Another issue is the U.S.-Korea civil nuclear agreement. The 123 agreement has been stalled. The negotiations for that have been stalled. Experts tell me that basically the two governments need to reach some sort of an agreement by May, June of this year. And if you take into account the time it takes to transition, both in the new government in South Korea as well as the new State Department and DOD here, they won't have much time to work on that. And that's a very important issue. I mean, it doesn't get as much play here in the United States, but I think for the Koreans, it's a huge, huge issue. And then the third, as you said, is OPCON transition. And that will happen within, according to schedule, within the presidencies of these two leaders. And whether that goes through successfully will, I think, be another major issue. There are others, but as with any relationship, while it's good to have a nice personal relationship between the leaders, that's very important. It sets the tone overall in the relationship. There are some real issues that they have to deal with here, and that their alliance managers are going to have to get to work on right away.
I actually see Park's platform as already essentially aligned with that of the United States in many respects. And there's a strong foundation upon which to build. Victor has named all of the major issues that could potentially be stumbling blocks, but quite frankly, I'm not really that concerned. I think that there is a sufficient foundation upon which both governments can address these particular issues successfully. I had been worried about the nuclear cooperation agreement at one time. Now I'm less worried about it. I think there are ways that both governments can find to manage that issue. I think that because there are clear converging interests, there's really not an issue, not a subject issue on the horizon or on the agenda that we shouldn't be able to address.
Joe, as you know, Korea is not the only place that had a leadership transition. We've also seen it recently. The LDP come back into power with it, and we're expecting Shinzo Abe to become the next prime minister in Japan, and of course Xi Jinping taking over China. What's your sense of, with all of these new leaders in place in this region, what do you think the state of the relationship is going to be with Korea with these two important neighboring powers?
No, it's a great question. It's an interesting time because, as you indicated, you have a new administration's coming in Tokyo, certainly in Beijing with the Xi Jinping government, and so now with the ROK, with the Park administration. To get back to North Korea, because it does touch the three of these countries in a rather significant way, it's also an opportunity for North Korea to get a message out to three new governments in three major nation states that we want to engage and we want to get movement and so forth. I think the relationship among the three countries there, certainly with China and Xi Jinping coming into power there. I mean, I think China. There's so many domestic issues, and I think you were asking a few minutes ago about the situation in the ROK. Well, the globalization is affecting all of us in such a profound way, and what have you. And there are so many issues in China that Xi Jinping, that government in China, has to address. Certainly the government in Japan with the Abe government has to address, as the administration of President Park will have to address. So there are a lot of domestic imperatives there, but it also speaks to cooperation in a multilateral sense. And it's not just with respect to North Korea, which is a very important piece of that equation, but in an economic sense. Victor talked about FTA and so forth. Well, we have the Sunkakus, we have the Paracels, we have the Spratlys and so forth. We have the Doctor situation. These are issues that should not, one would hope that the new leadership in these countries would not make these issues so central so that it affects the bilateral, the multilateral aspects of regional cooperation. in an economic sense, so to work on some of the issues that really impact the electorate in these countries. We're talking about disparity of wealth. We're talking about GDP. We're talking about economic growth that's slowing down and so forth. These are the engines that keep the countries going. So I would imagine this enlightened leadership, the electorate and elected individuals who would provide leadership, enlightened leadership, to move these issues and not have some of these other issues that touch nationalism and so forth impact in a negative sense the more profound issues that affect the well-being of the people in the respective countries. Short way of saying, I would expect, hopefully, that the North would be appreciative of their opportunities now to impress the new leadership coming into these respective governments and the new leadership in these three governments, appreciating their need to ensure that there is better cooperation, not more tension. We don't need more tension, because more tension just works to aggravate the economic situation and to fuel those who want to see this sort of conflict in the region and so forth. So I'm relatively optimistic that this leadership will address some of the issues that are tense, issues that are that touch the nationalistic chord in some of these countries in a more significant way, and to modulate that and to bring it down to a meaningful level so that there could be better cooperation.
Victor, are you as optimistic as Joe is? And let's focus on the Korea-Japan relationship.
Yeah, well, I'm certainly as hopeful as Joe is. I think that Pakane and Shinzo Abe, there are many things that they could agree on with regard to their worldview, with regard to a whole number of things. There are many things that they could agree on, and I think they could get along famously. As long as some of these historical issues don't raise their ugly heads. Frankly, the scenario that worries me is not that Prime Minister Abe is going to say something that's provocative, but that one of his people in some, you know, side press interview will say something that then gets blasted around the Ethernet as being the position of the Abe government on comfort women or something like that. And, you know, with Pakane as the first, not only first female president of Korea, but first female head of state in all of Northeast Asia, that'd be very difficult, I think, for her. So that's, you know, the thing I think we all want to avoid. But aside from that, I think there's a lot of potential in a relation, in an Abe-Pak relationship. And on China as well, I mean, the Chinese have already come out and said very positive things about the election, about Park Geun-hye. She's obviously no stranger to Beijing. She was Lee Myung-bak's special envoy, I think, when he first came into office. and I think Park Geun-hye has made pretty clear, while she sees the foundation of her foreign policy being the alliance with Korea, at the same time, you know, the reality is that China is right on their doorstep, so that they need to have a good relationship and perhaps improve it from the perceived stasis in China-South Korea relations under Lee Myung-bak. So, you know, I think in many ways you'll have, as Joe said, you have leaders in all these countries, but I think there'll be a lot of interest by both the Japanese and the Chinese in pursuing a good relationship with, you know, this very new and different leader in Korea. So. You know, I think that speaks very well, hopefully, for the future, and perhaps a reinvigorated sort of plus three mechanism. So.
Well, you know, I think the thing to really highlight here is certainly Madam Park is aware that Korea is potentially the biggest loser from rising tensions in Northeast Asia. And she also has already put forward what I think is a very interesting proposal that was unveiled back in November in the Wall Street Journal, the Northeast Asia Peace and Cooperation Initiative, where she addresses specific aspects of tensions in Northeast Asia, historical and territorial disputes, North Korea, concerns about rising militarization. And essentially, in many respects, I think that proposal, it reminds me a little bit of Kim Dae-jung's approach to the region, really trying to promote greater cooperation based on higher levels of political will, and as she puts it, responsibility. The sticking point is that when she comes to responsibility, you know, there are two areas where she's calling for responsibility, and I just don't know whether the response is going to be what she envisions. And one is related to whether or not Japan will adopt what she calls a correct view of history, and the other is the question of how North Korea will respond. But the other aspect of the vision that I think is important is that she sees the importance of a cooperative U.S.-China relationship. And I think the reason for that is that it opens up space for South Korea to engage more effectively with China as well.
Well, thank you. I want to give our audience an opportunity to ask questions as well to our panelists. As you prepare your questions, I want to ask one final question to our experts here, which is, what do you think will be President Lee Myung-bak's legacy? How do you think history will remember President Lee Myung-bak as he steps down from office? Let's start with Joe.
Well, let me go back to North Korea then, because you mentioned that before. I think history will view the legacy of Lee Myung-bak as a with respect to North Korea as a policy, a principled policy of reciprocity, which is counter to, you know, whether it was the policy of past administrations, the Noh Moo-hyun and Kim Dae-jung, et cetera. But it would be expectations that there be reciprocity, that there will be something in return, and that there will be goodwill on the other side and so forth. So I think in that sense, with respect to that element of relations, which are so critical for the national security interests in the region, certainly for the Korean Peninsula, I think he'll be remembered in a very positive way, that he put a marker down for the North, that there are expectations that they have to perform also. It's not just a one-way street. So I think in that respect, I think the economic situation, I'll defer to my colleagues on that, because all countries have been affected so profoundly by the economic currents in the world and what have you. These are issues that certainly are difficult for all countries to address, and I think the legacy for many countries is that these issues that have to be addressed in a more significant way, with greater resources and maybe even greater creativity. Victor,
So I would say two things on North Korea. I think one, I don't know if this is a legacy so much, but I think when people look back on Lee Myung-bak's North Korea policy, they will probably say that it was not as hardline as people think it is today. Because, you know, over the course of his time in office, he offered a number of initiatives, the 3,000 proposal, a number of initiatives. But as Joe said, very clearly conditional on reciprocity. There had to be some sort of reciprocal act by the North. And because the North didn't reciprocate, Lee Myung-bak basically washed his hands of the problem. So I think while everybody, I mean, the knee-jerk reaction is just to describe this current outgoing administration's policy as just super hard line, the hardest line policy we've seen in a long time. I don't think it was for lack of trying. I mean, I think they really tried to do some things, and maybe there were problems in the implementation of it, but I think that was there. The legacy, I think, will be global Korea. He really, during his 5 years, took Korea from a sort of a bit regional player into making them really a player on the global stage, whether you were talking about in climate change or in peacekeeping operations or the G20, the Nuclear Security Summit. That was part of his objective, was to not become a country that was solely focused and obsessed with the North Korea problem, but there was a much bigger world out there that Korea was playing as a part of. And I think he was successful in terms of doing that. And he set a standard such that every administration that comes in from now on, one of the questions will be, are you going to keep Korea global? And I think that will be a question for Park Geun-hye. I think she will. But I think that will be a question for Park Geun-hye. But I think he really set the standard in that sense.
Yeah, I very much agree on global Korea, the idea of raising Korea's profile on the international stage. But the other thing that I think bears highlighting is that the Lee Myung-bak administration was effective in keeping Korea afloat economically under very difficult circumstances. And really, when you stop and think about it, the fact that South Korea, not a large country, is actually the eighth largest exporter in 2011, despite these adverse, you know, economic circumstances, you know, shows that they really took the idea of the FTAs, they embraced them, and that it has paid some dividends. Now, there's a flip side in terms of perceptions of economic inequality domestically, but there's no doubt that overall Korea's profile, you know, as a top 10 economy, has been enhanced over the course of the past 5 years.
Well, great. Well, now I'd like to give our audience an opportunity to ask questions. And of course, Chris Nelson is the first one to jump out of his seat. But so if you don't mind identifying yourself and keeping your questions brief so we can get as many questions as possible during our final half an hour period. So let's start with Chris, and then we'll move to the gentleman in the back.
Thanks, and thanks for the metaphorical jump anyway. It's so interesting to hear the discussion of the difference between hope and what we're worried about. And in a sense, I have the same question for two different things. One is on North Korea, another is on Japan, South Korea. In listening to you guys with your really excellent discussion and reading all the things we've been seeing lately, it seems as though we still don't have a sense of, do we need to reach out to the North Koreans because they're still testing this stuff we don't like? Or are we in a situation where we have to wait to see how they respond to the idea of reaching out? In other words, is the lack of a provocation enough for us to reach out? Or how do you get past this chicken and egg problem? Either we ought to reach out or not. Either we are worried about continued testing or we're not. You know, how do you, it seems like a built-in contradiction. Similar issue with Japan, South Korea. The way you listen to the campaign and what you see now going on, do you think the Park administration will feel an imperative to keep pushing on Dokdo, regardless of what the Japanese are saying or doing about Takashima? And conversely, do you think Abe, as prime minister, is going to feel obligated for domestic reasons to push on, God help us, history and comfort women, regardless of whether how that would impact on Mrs. Park? So in a sense, I'm asking sort of three separate chicken and egg questions, and who might move first, and of course, the bottom line for us is, how do we urge a restraint, or do we simply make clear that's what we hope for? Thanks.
Mm-hmm. You want to take a first cut?
Well, let me just start on North Korea, Chris. There's been no lack of trying, I think, on the part of the U.S. and the ROK and others. I'm speaking personally now of reaching out to the North Koreans. The dialogue has always been there. The opportunity has always been there. And what have you. I think we remember going back to the February agreement and so forth, where we were prepared to provide nutritional assistance to North Korea, and then that was dashed with the April missile launch and so forth. So I don't think there's any ambiguity there. I don't think anyone is just sort of sitting back waiting for the North Koreans to reach out or to express a willingness to re-engage. I think the engagement has always been on the table. It's just that the North Koreans have, unfortunately, have pursued their own path, and with these two missile launches in one year, what needs to happen is to come back to a six-party process, where everything is on the table, and they come back to what Kim Jong-un's father said was a commitment on the part of North Korea to abide and implement the September 2005 joint statement, which speaks to comprehensive, verifiable denuclearization. In return for economic and benefits and security assurances, ultimately normalization, et cetera, et cetera. So I mean, I think it's always been there. I just don't think anyone has been remiss in that regard. I think with the Abe government coming in, this is a very the LDP is a very strong government. He's a very strong leader. He has strong views and so forth. I just don't see. My personal view. I just don't see. Whether it be Dokdo or whether it be the comfort woman issue and some of these other issues here, as issues that anyone would want to make front burner issues. I think that there needs to be some common ground, some effort to modulate, to put these not so much on the front burner but on a back burner, so that there would be progress in resolving them. Obviously, they have to be resolved and so forth, but not making them impediments to better bilateral, multilateral relations.
On North Korea, I think North Koreans would be happy to go back to a dialogue. As long as they can continue to consolidate their position as an ICBM and nuclear weapons capable state, I'm sure they'd be happy to come back to dialogue. And the thing that worries me, frankly, about the current situation is, they want to try to get everyone normalized to the idea that they have ballistic missiles and nuclear weapons, right? And then maybe engage in arms control discussions. That's fine. You know, that they're happy to do that, and get everybody off this idea that six-party or any sort of negotiation is about denuclearizing North Korea. And they've just done a successful launch that put a payload into orbit. And we really haven't seen much of a response from the international community. So in that sense, they are kind of getting what they want. I mean, we've kind of become desensitized to the fact that they're plodding very methodically along this path to developing this long-range ICBM technology and then nuclear warheads. And so as long as that's the case, I'm sure they'd be happy to come back to talks. And I think the challenge was suggested by Chris's question is, what does a U.S. administration or a new South Korea administration do when the notion of going back to dialogue for us is about denuclearization, but for them is precisely about normalizing their status as a weapons-capable state.
I would say that there are two main reasons why it's necessary for the Park administration to reach out and actually test North Korea. It's not that the testing is all going one way. Park Geun-hye also has the opportunity to test the North. One is that a stable inter-Korean relationship is really, I think, a number one security prerequisite for economic growth and for Korea, for South Korea to feel stable. Secondly, I think that there is a domestic political imperative in light of essentially a divided electorate on what the best policy is toward North Korea. And so this kind of synthetic approach that she seems to be pursuing, I think it has to play out before it's going to be possible to have sufficient public support to try anything else. Sure. And so, I think for those reasons, it's, important for Madam Park to have, the opportunity to see, knock on North Korea's door. Everybody in the region is for North Korean economic reform except the North Koreans. So why not give it one more test? On the Japan-Korea relationship, I think that Madam Park is constrained. And she's already stated in a very clear way what her view is and what her hope is with regard to responsibility for, or historical correctness might be the way to put it. It's going to be an increasing challenge, I think, for us to manage that. So we'll see how it plays. That's actually where I think the train wreck is right now, not nuclear cooperation, but potential for things to go bad in the South Korea-Japan relationship.
I hesitate to go down this path because any discussion of North Korea goes nowhere. But I guess the question would be, President Park could test them, but to test them to do what? Test them to show that they're genuine about inter-Korean cooperation and denuclearization, or
Yeah, to move down the path of, you know, a stable inter-Korean relationship, and to address the security issues that she's already flagged, you know, both in her first statement, you know, a grave, you know, situation that was created by the North Korean satellite launch, you know, and, you know, the fact that that shadows South Korean security. It casts a shadow over South Korean security. So I think she has to, you know, it's really incumbent upon a new leadership to at least knock on the door. There simply is not, I think, at this stage, a political basis in South Korea for not trying to knock on the door.
The gentleman back there, and then we'll take some questions here.
Yeah, thank you. Jim Delaney here. Do we have any idea among the panelists who Ms. Park will pick as her national security team? I think the national security advisor will be much more important to the relationship between Washington and Seoul than the defense minister or the foreign minister. I also think that the next ambassador to U.S. from Korea will be a very important pick. Do we have any ideas what the national security team will look like?
Any ideas?
Well, I have a hard enough time keeping up with names here in Washington, much less trying to project who's going to be running foreign policy in Seoul. But I think we know a number of members of the team. You know, and I don't know what positions they're going to get, but, you know, former minister here and former national security advisor Yoon Byung-se has been playing an active role. You know, many of us know Chung Min Lee, who's also been engaged on the team, and, you know, there are a number of others across the board, you know, for specific issues.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree. I mean, there's sort of, she's had throughout the campaign this inner circle of advisors on foreign policy, as she has on other issues. And they're familiar to many of us already here in Washington. I mean, I would add Kil Jong-un to that group also, the former journalist, now National Assemblyman.
Shim Yun-jo.
Right, right. So there are a number that have, either from the journalistic world or who have turned to politicians or from the foreign ministry, professionals who I think are quite good and quite strong. I would agree with Jim that especially at the beginning of a new administration, the relationship between the Blue House and the White House is incredibly important, and the phone calls that would take place between the two, either to clear the air or to make sure certain press statements were not misinterpreted, I think it's very important in the very beginning of an administration that there are no misunderstandings about statements that are made, particularly on the South Korean side, because there will be some, you know, our president has been there before, and he'll get a question on North Korea, but it'll be, you know, maybe one of a dozen others on the Middle East or something else. But, you know, all the questions for her will look at North Korea, the U.S., and some of these other things. So having that national security advisor or that Blue House team that is in early contact with our NSC, I think, is very important.
Right here, and then Florence in the back.
I'm Jin Ning Nguyen with Voice of Vietnamese Americans. Let's talk economic. Where do you see President Park and her agenda for the regional, especially the Southeast Asia, in the big picture of economy? And between the U.S. and China, where do you see President Park would take South Korea to be a partner in promoting the regional development and economic, and also balancing the powers? It has also to do with security. Do you see that she used that to engage China in the talk with North Korea? Because based on the economy, based on the pocket, not just fighting, not just conflicting. So I'm more interested in the current situation in the Southeast Asia Sea, or South China Sea, and the talk of joint development. Recently, Australia has come in and suggested a new equilibrium but it's suggesting that we leave Indochina and Southeast Asia Sea into the China's sphere of influence, and whether you see President Park would position South Korea in that picture.
I don't think I've seen any platform statements regarding Korea's involvement or relationship to security issues in the South China Sea or in Southeast Asia yet. I think it is notable that the ASEAN-Korea economic relationship has been growing very fast, and so that's, I think, significant. What might be more interesting is a specific proposal that Park has made for a U.S.-China-Korea dialogue. That's something that I think, you know, both Victor and I have advocated in various places and we'd very much like to see. I don't see that as necessarily having as much of an economic component as a security and confidence building component, and if obviously it has special salience to North Korea.
Florence?
Florence Lowley, Global America Business Institute. This question is actually directed to Scott regarding the U.S.-Korea cyber-nuclear agreement. You have said that you are a little less concerned now than before. Is it because of the election of Madam Park, or is it because of possible or expected changes in personnel in U.S. government, or is it just something you just woke up feeling good about it?
Well, I mean, you know, the nuclear cooperation agreement involves a lot of technical issues. And so for somebody like me, I actually have to try to study and make sure I understand, at least to the extent possible, some aspects of those technical issues. And, you know, as I look at those issues and based on what I, you know, understand, you know, from a political perspective, I just think that it's very clear that the benefits that derive to both countries from nuclear cooperation so far outweigh the costs of not having an agreement, that I think that both sides will find a way to address the specific issues as sticking points. And I actually believe there also is, there should be potential for adjustments on some of the specific most sensitive issues that I think can allow for this not to be a train wreck.
Well, there's a lot of questions here, so let's, and we only have 20 minutes, so let's take a couple of questions at a time. So let's go with...
Thanks. Bob Doner at the Treasury. I wonder if you'd talk a bit about economic policy. Will the new administration have the same growth orientation as the Lee administration? Will they be as determined in negotiating free trade agreements? Will they directly address inequality in the economy, and what, if anything, will be done about the Chaebol?
Can I ask a two-finger?
Just since I'm sitting right here. Matt Goodman from CSIS. Can I ask, so Korea has been somewhat reluctant to join the TPP, and you can explain that through, you know, economic, well, you explained it just fatigue from CORUS and, you know, potentially that the economic gains, because CORUS, you know, established most of the gains that Korea is going to get from TPP, you know, there's the marginal gain is relatively limited, whereas other agreements with China or ASEAN may, in the sort of narrow sense, produce greater gain for them. But do you detect, you guys, any sense of strategic tilt there, that they are worried about being seen as too much, you know, pursuing an initiative that is perceived in the region as being driven by the United States versus you know, wanting to show a little more of a tilt in this area towards, you know, China or ASEAN for that matter.
So let's hold that question and let's take one, two, right there. Right here and right here. Let's take three at a time.
Hi, I'm Dan Segalen from the PBS NewsHour. If what you say is true, that North Koreans are going to do something provocative and test the South Korean government, should the South Korean military and the U.S. military change their posture now? Do you expect them to do something to send any kind of signal?
Hello, I'm Yanggi Kim Reno from George Washington University. Let me just give you a very, very small, maybe detracting episode. I taught at Seogang University when she was a senior majoring in engineering. She participated in an English speech contest where I was one of the judges. She was by far the best, but we gave her a second prize. We exercised reverse discrimination because her daddy was the president. But anyway, I remember her saying in some interview, somebody asked who she respected the most, and she said her parents. But on the other hand, she apologized to the so-called victims of previous President Park's, people who were persecuted by him. So I'm wondering, I know what she actually meant in both cases, but I'd like to know what others interpret. I mean, what legacy will she want to continue? And she will actually, because she will be a global president with such a very well-rounded background, I cannot possibly think her English is worse than so many years ago, given all her experiences. So I'm very hopeful for another global president, but all foreign policies based on domestic issues. So how would she actually accommodate these kind of seemingly opposing legacy she'd like to continue?
Okay, so just to summarize the three questions. One is regarding the growth policy. What is Park Geun-hye's growth policy and possible future of TPP and Korea's involvement in TPP? And the question right here about North Korea's, if North Korea is going to provoke, should the U.S. and South Korea prepare now, posture themselves now to prepare for such a provocation? And then finally, legacy issues regarding, her father's, the comments that she had made about her father's past and basically.
Can you assign us questions to save time?
Sure. Growth policy. Since you wrote a great book, edited a great volume. How about Victor about the apology issue and the and Park Geun-hye, her recent apology statement about her father's past, and then about the North Korea policy.
Right. Got it.
Well, I can assure you that my book was not about economic policy or growth. I think that so far what I see suggests that there's probably going to be a continued desire for Korea to be a leading exporter. You know, the big challenge is related to this economic democratization, which is really about internal issues, distribution issues. I think there's some interesting questions in South Korea about tax policy, for instance, that could feed into this issue of distribution. On TPP, I do think that it's likely that in the back of Koreans' minds there is the relationship with China and the trilateral cooperation component of the initiative that she has put forward on peace and cooperation in Northeast Asia, which suggests closer Japan, China, South Korea cooperation. You know, having said that, I don't think that means that this government is likely to be, you know, opposed to being a part of TPP. I just think that they have other sets of issues that they want to work out as a priority before they are likely to get to that question.
So I'm gonna try to answer a little bit of each, if that's okay, because I can't resist.
You remember them all, right?
Yeah, I'm trying to keep them all in my head. So the So I think on the growth issues, I mean, just based on what I've read, I mean, I haven't had conversations with their economic advisors, but so clearly one aspect of it is growth, but and the other is that she wants to do a lot of things without increasing taxes, right? That's a trick. I don't know how you do that. And there seem to be a number of measures that are meant to be prophylactics against any other debt crisis And I think there are specific measures like, you know, rolling over periods of loans and trying to actually create a fund for in case, because of such a highly leveraged society, fund so that they won't fall into that sort of crisis. Chabal reform, obviously, is a big issue. And ironically, I think she's probably much more credible on Chabal reform than a progressive president in that sense. On TPP, I mean, I think yes, the Koreans, as you said, Matt, I mean, they see it as, it's like, why do you want to do root canal again, right? Having gone through it once already with the bilateral FTA. And there is, I think, an attraction that they see to sort of unplowed ground with China, possibly. But I would agree with Scott. I don't think this means TPP is off the radar screen. I think we should certainly press it with the next administration, but with a light touch. And then in many ways, if they're interested in pursuing some pre-talks or pre-negotiations with the Chinese or continuing the ones they're having now on some sort of preferential trading arrangement, then more power to them. They should go ahead. But keep TPP on the radar screen, not try to jam it down their throats. And eventually, I think they'll come around. I think they will. On Dan's question on North Korea, it's a fair question. The problem I have is I don't think, I mean, I hate to say this before the cameras, but I don't think we've been very good at deterring North Korean provocations. We're good at deterring, the U.S. military is good at deterring a second North Korean invasion. And we've been good at doing that for 60 years now. But developing their missile programs, testing their missiles, testing their nuclear weapons, we haven't been very good at deterring that. And so even if we expect something like that to be coming, I don't know what we could do to deter it. Stand up missile defense in the region, we've done that. And yet they continue to do these sorts of things. So, and quite frankly, the fact, at least up until now, that there hasn't been a strong international response to the launch last week, I mean, that is clearly not a deterrent to them doing more sorts of things. So that's what worries me. Then lastly, on Park Chung-hee versus Park Geun-hye, I mean, certainly I understand that Park Chung-hee elicits all sorts of views from Koreans at all ends, both ends of the spectrum. I think it's just, yes, she is his daughter, but we are just talking about such a different Korea today. That the notion that somehow she's going to learn or borrow from the leadership style of her father, you know, over a Korea that was a completely different place than it is today. It's really, I mean, the comparison, you can't even compare the two. So.
She was legitimately and, you know, fairly and popularly elected.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so actually the big test is now as she governs, she also needs to be responsive to democracy.
You know, in Victor's point, right at the beginning of globalization, I mean, South Korea is a global player. The Nuclear Security Summit and many of the other things that the South Koreans and the Im Yun-bak government have shown significant leadership with has put South Korea front and center in that regard. That's a very powerful piece. That really is. And all the sense one has is the Park administration will continue, and you mentioned that in your question also, continue with the globalization, the leadership role that the South Korean government has shown to the world. And that's so positive. I would imagine that resonates in Pyongyang if that news gets to Pyongyang. And as more information is getting into North Korea, it is resonating. And that to me is has a profound impact on the people in the North, the people who are malnourished, the people who are looking for something more in life than some of the travail they're going through and so forth. So on your question of if there is further escalation, as Victor said, the playbook is that they do escalate. I'm hoping they will not escalate because they have to change that playbook. There's a new government there. And Abraham, your question, you have three new heads of state and you have a reelected President Obama administration. there's an opportunity for a new government in Pyongyang to change that playbook and not to further escalate. Because if there is further escalation, the U.S. and the ROK, we're prepared for escalation. And I think the DPRK knows if they should do something on the NLL, something similar to the shelling of the island and so forth, there will be a response from the ROK. So I don't think, I don't see that recklessness coming out of the North now with this, with the new government. And hopefully I'm correct in that regard. But indeed, the U.S. and the ROK are prepared for any form of escalation.
Let's take another set of questions. The gentleman in the back, and then one right here, and one right there.
Thank you. 12 years ago this week, I was taking a final exam in one of your courses, Dr. Cha, back at Georgetown. And the reason I mention it is because in that course, and by the way, my name is Jason Olson with the World Bank, and the reason I mention it is because one of the topics we touched on in that class 12 years ago was the impact of the Asian financial crisis on South Korea and its politics and its society. And now as we fast forward to today, with 2013 expected to be a year of extreme downside risks within the global economy and within many of South Korea's export markets and within the industries with which it considers significant, I'm wondering, A, what sorts of policies are you all looking for that will suggest that a Park administration is managing those downside risks, and B, to what extent do you see there being an impact on domestic and regional policy for South Korea if they fail to manage those risks? Thank you.
Yes, Dave Fitzgerald, private consultant. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about whether you see a revival of the military and intelligence sharing agreements between Japan and South Korea in the next 6 months of 2013 as a possible way to redirect the bilateral relationship in ways that we find very supportive and get away from some of these bad territorial and historical tendencies of the last of the last year.
Great. Dan, right here.
Nicholas Hemisevich from the Korea Economic Institute. On the domestic side of things, does Park Geun-hye's experience in the National Assembly kind of help her work with the National Assembly to come up with some of the policies to address some of the issues that the electorate was concerned about during the election, or does a numbers game or opposition blocking her or trying to block her prevent that? So I guess basically, does she have an opportunity to work with the National Assembly and try and enact some of these policies that she came up with during the campaign?
Okay. So, Victor, first question was directed to you. So how about the downside risks of Korea facing in the global economy? Are they preparing for this risk? And how about Joe tackling the Korea-Japan military intelligence mm-hmm. sharing, if you foresee mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. Emerging again and the possibility to get that through? Mm-hmm. And then Scott on the Hawkins National Assembly experience, helping her work with that body. So.
First thing I would say is I'm happy to see that you're gainfully employed. and so that education did help, I presume.
Now, what was the grade in the course? No.
We are literally not even in the first day of this administration, and so all we know in terms of their economic policies are some of the platforms that they've printed out. So it's hard to say. But I mean, I think one of the things that I think is encouraging was this emphasis on trying to find ways to ensure the Korean economy against another sort of spiraling crisis that is started by by the inability to roll over debt, right? And so I think that's certainly positive. Now, whether she can actually do those things, create a, whatever it was, 13 trillion won fund that would be available, where you raise that kind of money or some of the other things that she has in mind in terms of allowing for both institutions as well as individual households to not be so exposed as they might be today. You know, I don't know how she's going to get from here to there. I understand what her vision is, but I don't know how she's going to get from here to there. So all I can say is that we have to wait and see. I would say, in terms of the economy, that and again, I'm not an economist, but my sense is that one of the reasons why you have this situation where you have such a high number of educated Koreans who are either unemployed or underemployed in the Korean economy is that the Korean economy is in the middle of this transformation. I mean, moving from, as you said, they're focused on exports, and yes, to an extent, that has been the bread and butter of the economy. But the future of the Korean economy is in the service industry. Right? It's not in continuing to try to, compete with China or India or others in terms of exports. And, you know, that was, I think, one of the selling points of the FTA, was that it would open the Korean service sector to international competition and then therefore incentivize them to become world-class competitors in these sorts of sectors, which would then open up all sorts of employment opportunities for educated, college-educated Koreans. So.
No, I think that would be great if there could be that element of cooperation between the ROK and the government of Japan on issues like that that speak to their respective national security issues. There's no question. But as we saw what happened a few months ago, there was an element of a reaction there, and hopefully that will be overcome. And these elements that speak indeed directly to national security interests, are front and center and take priority concern and focus. And there would be that cooperation between both governments on those critical issues.
Yeah, based on my experience watching former National Assemblymen as presidents in South Korea, it doesn't necessarily help that much. What does help, I think, is having a party in the majority. And of course, Senuri does have a slim majority currently in the National Assembly. I think under DJ they changed the rules so that there's a little bit more distance between the president's ability to control the party or to influence the National Assembly. And as a result, it's been a more complicated relationship.
Well, our time has come to an end, and I think we speak for all of us where we hope and look forward to another productive chapter in the U.S.-Korea relationship. And thank you very much, gentlemen, for your insights. Please help me thank our guests. Thank you.
Chris, how are you doing, man? Have a good day. All right.